Die Übersetzung von Jans Stimme vom Deutschen ins Englische wurde mit einer KI erstellt.
For about a week and a half now, the conflict between Israel and Iran has been escalating noticeably. The United States has intervened militarily, while the Iranian regime is striking back. At the same time, the war is spreading beyond the immediate area. Attacks are hitting several countries across the Gulf region. Hezbollah has also entered the fighting from Lebanon. As a close ally of Tehran, it is financed and militarily supported by Iran. For people in northern Israel, this means living under constant stress. In places like Metula, right on the border, sirens sometimes sound throughout the night. Rockets, drones, impacts, often in rapid succession. In the Arab town of Arab al-Aramsheh, there is sometimes not even enough time for a warning. Many people can hardly sleep anymore. Some have fled, while others stay, out of defiance, a sense of duty, or simply because they cannot bear to leave everything behind once again. Hanging over everything is the same question. How far can this conflict escalate? What is unfolding along the northern border is no longer just a local confrontation. It is part of the broader power struggle between Israel and Iran, with Hezbollah acting as an extension of Tehran. And for the people on the ground, it means one thing above all: living in a state of emergency with no clear end in sight.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Hello, I'm Jan Jessen, war and crisis reporter for the Funke Media Group. I've been reporting for years from conflict zones in Ukraine, Syria, and Iraq. Now I'm traveling in northern Israel, in Metula, and in the Arab village of Arab al-Aramsheh, right on the border with Lebanon. There I spoke with people who explained to me what the current situation is like. Since the attack by the United States and Israel on Iran, the war has expanded significantly. Countries now affected include Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, as well as Iraq and Jordan. Hezbollah is attacking northern Israel from Lebanese territory. Israel, in turn, is striking back, launching massive air raids on Lebanon and sending ground troops into the country, into southern Lebanon. Dozens of people are dying every day. And while there is ongoing discussion about missile defense systems, drones, and military strategies, people here in northern Israel are trying to maintain something like a normal daily life, between sirens, shelters, and the question, should we flee again or should we stay? In this episode, you'll hear voices. We walk through Metula with a resident. We speak with a restaurant owner there who barely gets any sleep at night, with a social worker who takes care of elderly and sick people, and with a security expert at the border who explains why this war is different from the previous one. I've now been in Israel for several days. I'm based, so to speak, in Tel Aviv, this beautiful city on the Mediterranean. A few days ago, I traveled to Metula in the far north of Israel, and that's where I went first. Metula is a small village right on the border with Lebanon. The border fence, where I was, is only a few meters away. After October 7th, 2023, when Hezbollah intervened in the war alongside Hamas, Metula became a restricted military zone. The village was completely evacuated. There were no civilians left, only soldiers. After a ceasefire in November 2024, people began to return. When I drove to Metula, I was a bit surprised that it was actually possible to get there without any difficulty. There was hardly any military presence in the area. Above Metula itself, there was an Israeli military base, but even the soldiers there seemed completely relaxed, which was somewhat surprising. Normally, the Israeli armed forces are very restrictive when it comes to journalists, but in this case, they were entirely relaxed and did not interfere with our work at all. I then walked around Metula for a while. The village was eerily quiet. It was around 9 or 9:30 in the morning. Everything was completely still. You had the impression that Metula was deserted. There were only a few cars driving around, very few people, and that's where I met Shira, I spoke with her about what has been happening in Matula since Hezbollah re-entered the war.
The situation is not so good. We don't sleep. We need to sleep in the morning because all the night the attack starts. Many people leave this area because they can't be here. It's so terrified, and it's not the easy life we want. All our friends not here. They go to Elat because they want to escape from here. But we love the place, so we need to stay here. It's so hard. Yeah. I don't lie. But now it's very quiet now. Yeah.
Shira then showed me videos on her phone, footage from the night before, and it was pretty intense to watch. You could see rockets flying, explosions lighting up the sky. There was a constant barrage of noise, artillery fire, blasts, gunshots. It was obvious that it had been a very, very difficult night for the people in Matula, and that's exactly what everyone we spoke to there told us. But interestingly, life somehow goes on in Matula. Even Shira, who showed me those videos, would laugh from time to time. You get the sense that people in northern Israel are used to war, that they feel a certain fear, a certain respect for it, but that it has also become part of their everyday lives. And despite everything, they try to maintain that sense of normalcy. The same is true for Arab al-Aramshe. It's a small village also located right on the border, a bit further to the west. Arab al-Aramshe is a Bedouin Arab community. The people there, of course, know exactly what war means. The last conflict with Hezbollah isn't that long ago, and now it's starting all over again.
The situation here is very complex. We just come out of war and reconstruction, and it's happening again. There are many concerns because this time Iran is also to the war, not just the Hezbollah.
And of course, people have the feeling that the war never really ends. It just comes back in waves. Just when reconstruction is more or less complete, the next round begins. That's true for Arab al-Aramshe just as much as for Matula. It also applies to other towns in the region, like Kiryat Shmona. I was there the last time the war with Hezbollah was raging. Back then, these towns were heavily damaged. There were numerous strikes in the villages. Those damages have since been repaired. On the other side of the border, however, things look very different. When you look across from Arab al-Aramshe or Matula, you see completely destroyed Shia Arab villages in southern Lebanon. More than 150 villages have been devastated because Hezbollah operated from these areas, launching rockets, mortars, and grenade attacks, and sending infiltration units across the border. As a result, these Shia villages in the border region have been almost entirely reduced to rubble. Nothing but ruins remain. On the Israeli side, the situation looks completely different. The damage has largely been repaired. In fact, both Arab al-Aramshe and Matula appear almost like small, idyllic villages. They are set in a beautiful landscape. These could easily be tourist hotspots, rolling hills surrounding the villages, some forested, lots of greenery. And on the horizon, you can see mountain ranges that were still snow-capped. It's truly a stunning setting, peaceful and picturesque. But the problem, of course, is the war, which has now started again. Hezbollah decided to re-enter the conflict shortly after Israel and the United States attacked Iran, once again on Iran's side, which supports and finances the group. This has led to massive Israeli retaliation, dozens of airstrikes and the deployment of ground troops into southern Lebanon. On the Lebanese side, more than 400 people have already been killed, and there is a massive wave of displacement, with people fleeing from the south toward the north, toward Beirut and beyond. This is an extremely dramatic situation for the people in Lebanon. I had actually planned to go there as well, but at the moment, the airport in Beirut is closed, so it's simply not possible to get there right now. In Matula, I met Daniel Dorfman, a 42-year-old man who had just stepped out of his restaurant. He used to live in central Israel near Tel Aviv. For the past 16 years, he has been living right on the border with Lebanon, running a small restaurant. And he told me that the previous night had been the worst since the shelling began.
Last night was, I think, the worst night in terms of bombings from Lebanon. Or from Iran, or both, I don't know. All night, from about 8 in the evening, there was non-stop alarms and bombings and shootings. It was feeling like walking under fire. All the time people running to shelters and safe places. It's not quiet from the beginning, you know. The situation is that a lot of people left the town because they don't feel safe. You know, we are on the border and there are direct missiles that Hezbollah shoot, and you have 0 seconds of warning. Yeah. So even if you are in the middle of the street and you hear an alarm, you don't have time to find the shelter, and the bomb can fall on you.
So Daniel describes exactly what Shira also showed in the videos, nights when the sirens wail nonstop, when it feels as if you're going to work under fire. A major problem in Matula, and also in Arab al-Aramshe, is that there is barely any warning time. In Tel Aviv, where I am, when the sirens go off, you usually have 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 minutes to reach a shelter. You even get a kind of advance warning on your phone, a loud alarm that says the air raid alert could start soon, so prepare yourself. Then the air raid siren goes off, and you still have a little time to get to the shelter and be safe. In Matula and Arab al-Aramshe, it's not like that. There, the sirens sound, and the explosions often follow immediately. Sometimes, the residents told us, you even hear the impact of a strike before you hear the sound of the launch itself. Many people have left Matula for this reason, but some, like Daniel, stay, out of stubbornness, out of attachment, or simply because you can't flee every time Hezbollah fires. It's also important to note that back in October 2023, the Israeli government had asked people in the border region to evacuate. The government even arranged for people to stay in hotels in places like Tel Aviv, funding it themselves. This time they are not doing that. Instead, they are saying that, despite the ongoing shelling, people in the north are relatively safe, especially since Israeli ground troops have now entered southern Lebanon and established buffer zones.
You know, last time it was a good decision to evacuate the people from the border. But in the long term, it was a mistake. Because if we stayed, I think Matula wouldn't damaged, you know, like it was. 90% of the houses were hit in one way or another, because they knew people left the houses and only army stayed. So if we stayed last time, I think the situation were less severe, but and we stay now, you know, until there is no other option. And now the army is more prepared to the situation, and we learned the lesson from last time, I think. So it's good that we are staying here, you know. This is our houses, we don't need to flee. And if someone will come, we stay and fight.
Daniel also points out that the evacuation at the time was obviously a double-edged sword. On one hand, it provided protection for the people. The problem back then was that Hezbollah infiltration units had crossed the border. There was fear that what had happened previously in the kibbutzim near the Gaza Strip could happen again, that Hezbollah fighters might enter Israeli villages and commit massacres. But he also says that the evacuation meant the villages were heavily damaged, not completely destroyed, but at least 90% of the buildings were hit, because no civilians were left, only the army, making the villages a military target. That's why many now want to stay as long as possible. especially since they feel the army is better prepared this time than it was before. In fact, this war has never really stopped along this northern front or in Lebanon. There was a ceasefire in November 2024, which stipulated that Hezbollah should withdraw behind the Litani River. The Litani flows about 30 kilometers behind the border, roughly parallel to it. The agreement also stated that the Lebanese army would enter southern Lebanon, disarm Hezbollah, and destroy its infrastructure. Hezbollah, much like Hamas in Gaza, relies on tunnels for protection from airstrikes and to launch attacks from underground. The plan was for these tunnels to be destroyed by the Lebanese army, but that did not happen. I was in southern Lebanon in December and spoke with Christian residents of some villages there. They told me that Hezbollah was still present, which is why Israel has been conducting frequent strikes on Lebanon over the past year and a half, averaging about 2 airstrikes per day. The ceasefire, in other words, was extremely fragile. While we were standing in front of Daniel's restaurant, we could hear gunfire again. These were outgoing rounds, shells fired into Lebanon by the Israeli army. I also asked Daniel what kind of weapons Hezbollah is using here in the north and what worries him the most.
They have anti-tank missiles, like it's called Nuntet in Lebanon. So there's no warning against it. They shoot and it's like there's no system that can warn you against it. So this is really dangerous. Last time, a farmer, you know, have been killed here in the when he was working. And the other weapons they have, it's missiles and
Katyushas or something.
It's not Katyusha, it's a lot more advanced. Katyusha, it's like in the 80s, I think, or 90s. Now they have much more advanced weapons. They got it from Iran, of course. Hezbollah and Iran, it's the same.
No
difference. So they supplied them with more advanced weapons, and it can do really bad damage. Also the cluster missiles. But I think we are more prepared, and by now no one was hit or killed.
These are relatively simple rockets, the kind that Hamas and other Palestinian groups still use. Hezbollah, however, now has significantly more advanced weaponry capable of striking deeper into Israel. Just the day before our recording, on Monday, we witnessed this in central Israel. A projectile fired by Hezbollah toward Tel Aviv landed, or was intercepted, in Ramla, a few kilometers from Tel Aviv. Debris fell, and several people were injured. This wouldn't have been possible with the older Katyusha rockets, which have a very limited range. The bigger problem, Daniel says, is the anti-tank rockets Hezbollah is using. These have a relatively short range, but it's long enough to reach villages, and there's no warning because they can't be detected by radar. Naturally, that worries people when such projectiles come in. At the same time, Daniel emphasizes that they are better prepared now, and fortunately, no one has been killed. At the time of this podcast recording, there were no reports of civilian deaths at the border. On the day we were in Metula, 2 Israeli soldiers were killed in southern Lebanon. They were sappers working with a large recovery vehicle, repeatedly attacked, and they died. But as of this recording, no civilian fatalities. Like Daniel, all the people who remain in Metula or Arab al-Aramshi share a similar mindset. There's this mix of fear and resilience that you can feel throughout northern Israel and really across the country. Finally, I asked Daniel why he chose to move to Metula 16 years ago, a tiny patch of land right on the border, the first place to be hit whenever rockets come from Lebanon.
This is my home now.
Yes, he says this is his home. And that's exactly why he doesn't leave, despite the war. Others have said the same. After my conversation with Daniel in Metula, I met a social worker who was out with an acquaintance delivering ready-made meals to a client. They primarily take care of the elderly and sick residents in the village. She too emphasized the difficulty of the situation. And of course, I acknowledge that it's especially challenging right now in Metula.
Situation, like you see, it's not good. We think we don't have a missile, like I told you, direct mission.
We don't know if the missile...
They have everything. We must to take them, like you said, like I said. Go over the Litani. Maybe more. That's all.
Because they can shoot us without alarm, you know. They just, we hear the bomb and it's very dangerous to walk like this.
In Metula, there are actually shelters on almost every street corner, every few meters, in fact. These are small bunkers with steel doors. You go in, walk down a few steps, and you're immediately inside a protected space. Naturally, I asked the social worker what all this shelling means for those who cannot get to a shelter quickly, such as the elderly or people with disabilities, and then she said...
They stay in the room, in the safe room, or in the shelter, if they have. And if not, do we have a problem with them? Yes, maybe.
I also asked the two of them, similar to Daniel, back then, the government provided accommodation in safe areas. Are you being offered something like that this time as well?
No, and we don't want to.
Why?
No one wants to leave Metula. You want to leave Metula?
No.
They
suffer. We don't leave.
They suffer when we were out of Metula for 1.5 years. They suffer. The people are suffering. People die. People got sick. They don't want to leave Metula. No one wants to leave Metula. We live here. If they want, they will go.
That was actually the case. Back then, here at the hotel in Tel Aviv where I am now, I met people from Kiryat Shmona, from Metula, and from other villages in the north. They told me how difficult it was to be away from home for so long. Some were upset that they had left. Others were frustrated with the government because Metula had been declared a military zone. There were cases of depression, illness, and isolation, and some people even died far from home. Many say today that they would rather live under fire in Metula than be uprooted again for 1.5 years. But the war doesn't only affect the border villages in the north. Rockets are also falling in the greater Tel Aviv area. A few days ago, I visited Ichilov Hospital in Tel Aviv. Within 5 hours of the alert going off last Saturday, all seriously ill patients were moved underground. Parking garages were converted into emergency hospital spaces, a kind of massive bunker, housing all departments, including intensive care. Patients who could walk or were relatively stable were sent home and are now being monitored via telemedicine. It was incredible to see just how prepared this country is for war. When the sirens sound above ground, people in the second, third, and fourth basement levels definitely can't hear them. It's intense to see hundreds of beds lined up closely together. There's almost no privacy, yet the atmosphere was surprisingly good. A head nurse in orthopedics, Fasimi Hari, told me the situation isn't ideal, but morale is high, and both patients and staff feel safe. I also spoke with a patient, almost 70, originally from Berlin, sitting in a wheelchair beside her bed with a bandaged leg. She said they feel safe down here, and that you have to be patient and somehow cope with the situation. Meanwhile, while air raid alarms were going off above ground, nurses dressed with little elf wings were handing out Purim pastries to the patients. It was very touching. Purim is a Jewish holiday, somewhat similar to the German carnival. You really get the impression that they are maintaining daily life under extraordinary circumstances, 2 floors underground. Of course, the war doesn't only affect Jewish communities or predominantly Jewish cities like Tel Aviv, it also impacts Arab communities. A few kilometers from Metula in Arab al-Aramshe, I met Abid, the community manager. He told me that they too want to stay in their village despite the ongoing conflict.
Here the residents haven't left yet and don't intend to leave either. They are very connected to the land. But here, of course, they are asking for more protection and permanent solution, not another war every 2 years.
Arab Al-Aramshe is part of a larger Jewish municipality, so it's a village within this Israeli Jewish municipal structure and is actually quite well protected. The village has 9 bunkers for just 1,700 to 1,800 residents. That's significantly more than in any of the other Arab communities in Israel, highlighting a clear imbalance. Between the Arab, mostly Muslim communities and the Jewish communities, there are far fewer public shelters in the Arab areas. As I said, the people in Arab Al-Aramshe are lucky to be part of a larger Jewish municipality. The village itself is also very beautiful, charming little houses, farmsteads, and breathtaking scenery, much like in Metula. Arab Al-Aramshe is directly on the border with Lebanon. We were on a hill where you could look down at the massive border wall, several meters high, now reinforced with metal fences to prevent any infiltration from the other side. Beyond that, you could see the destroyed Lebanese villages, reduced to nothing but grey rubble. Abid told me that, although they have a lot of protection, in his view, it's still not enough.
We built security rooms in the past, but they are not up to standard. Today there are daily weapons and weapons, and we need to build stronger protection.
And in Arab Al-Aramshe, just like in Metula, a major problem is that the warning time is extremely short. Abid confirmed this to me as well.
The truth is, because we are very close to the border, sometimes there isn't much time. It's a matter of seconds. Many times there are times when there are no alarms because of the proximity to the border.
Despite all the protective measures, the bunkers in Arab Al-Aramshe, and the very detailed video surveillance, I even went inside one of the small monitoring bunkers where several soldiers watched the border on the other side to see if anyone is crossing. Abid said that people in Arab Al-Aramshe have been fearful of an invasion in recent days. There have been several attempts by Hezbollah fighters to breach the border, but the army has stopped them. To put all of this into perspective, I also spoke with Sarit Zahavi in the north. She is an Israeli analyst, formerly with military intelligence, and now heads the Alma Research Center, which has been studying the situation on the northern border for years. Of course, she analyzes things from a distinctly Israeli perspective, but her assessments are quite precise when it comes to the facts.
We are under constant fire of about an average of almost 50 attacks every day by Hezbollah. A third of the attacks are drones attacks, and two-thirds are with rockets, just what you just saw. Most of the attacks, but not all of them, are to the areas of what we call the borderline, which is up to 7 kilometers from the border. Mm-hmm. This is the second attack today, which is outside of the borderline. Mm-hmm. So there are attacks outside. Yesterday evening, there were a few barrages to Haifa. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the majority are to the borderline, but not all of them. We believe that Hezbollah's goal, the tactic goal, is to create again an evacuation of Israelis and to replicate the achievement they had in the previous war, that the communities were empty for a long time, for a year and a half.
Almost 50 attacks per day, a third of them carried out by drones, two-thirds by rockets. Most of these attacks are aimed at the so-called borderline region, about 7 kilometers deep into Israeli territory. But Zahavi says there are also repeated attacks outside this zone. I mentioned earlier that Tel Aviv, or the Greater Tel Aviv area, was attacked yesterday by Hezbollah. Zevi is convinced that Hezbollah has a tactical goal with what it's doing. From my impression, Hezbollah is not trying to bring the Israeli army to its knees. That would be impossible after years of war. They are definitely too weak for that now. The rocket fire is also not as intense or challenging as it was after October 7th, 2023. But Hezbollah could have the aim of forcing another evacuation of the villages in the north. From Israel's perspective, that would already feel like an admission of defeat, a sign of fear. Israel is trying hard to prevent that. Zehavi notes that Israel is responding partly through the deployment of ground troops to establish buffer zones, but she also emphasizes that the nature of the threat has changed.
We are under constant fire of drones and rockets, but the threat of direct shooting of anti-tank missiles or a huge invasion don't exist at the same way.
The last time I was in southern Lebanon, I was directly on the other side of the Israeli border in a Christian village. I spoke with people there about how they feel in this entire situation. They told me that Hezbollah has repeatedly tried to enter their village and launch rockets at Israel from there. The villagers have prevented this, saying they don't want to be drawn into the conflict. I also visited a UNIFIL camp, the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, staffed this time by soldiers from Ghana. I asked what the mission of UNIFIL is there, and I also asked about the role of the Lebanese army. Their task was supposed to be to disarm Hezbollah south of the Litani River and to control the south. Their answer was very clear.
No, IDF didn't fail. It didn't finish the job. Mm. The one who failed is the Lebanese government. Mm. What they are doing? They are cheating. Mm. It's as simple as that. Mm. They are cheating. They are collaborating with Hezbollah. Mm. And they had a fantastic PR to tell the whole world that they disarmed Hezbollah south of the Litani, which is proven to be a lie.
She said the IDF hasn't failed. I had also asked her whether what's happening now is an indication that the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, have failed. She said, no, they haven't failed. They just haven't finished the job, and it's the Lebanese government that has failed. She also told me that she thinks very little of what UNIFIL, the UN observation mission, is doing. She explained that the ammunition Hezbollah is currently using is stored in villages and houses. The Lebanese army has barely entered residential buildings, and if they have, it's often in coordination with Hezbollah. Additionally, false reports about what they supposedly found have been made. This has been a constant criticism from Israel. What the Lebanese government is doing is simply not enough. The Lebanese government is essentially afraid of Hezbollah's power, which remains a capable military force in Lebanon. To avoid angering Hezbollah and provoking what could turn into civil war-like clashes, the Lebanese government has done nothing to curb Hezbollah's capabilities. In Arab Al-Aramshe, I also spoke with Abid, the community manager. I had been struck by the rubble I saw on the other side of the border, the completely destroyed villages, and asked him whether Hezbollah fighters are still there. He said yes, of course, and assumes there are still Hezbollah fighters in tunnels that the IDF has not yet discovered. For the people in Metula and Arab Al-Aramshe, politics plays a relatively small role. The question of who is responsible for what is secondary. They experience the consequences directly. Sirens, strikes, and the uncertainty of whether the next night will be calm. Traveling in the north, you realize how abstract many debates in Europe sound about strategic buffer zones, drone warfare, decapitation strikes. For Shira, this simply means she no longer sleeps well. For Daniel, it means he only opens his restaurant for takeaway because the sirens could go off at any moment. For Abid in Arab Al-Aramshe, it means there may be just a second, or no warning at all, before danger strikes. For everyone there, it means living in a conflict that has long outgrown the Gaza conflict, where it all began. A conflict now threatening to engulf the entire region, in Lebanon, Jordan, Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and beyond, and a war that could destabilize the entire region. How long it will continue, whether Hezbollah will stop firing, whether a new agreement might be reached, or whether Iran will intervene directly, no one can predict this reliably at the moment. the Lebanese government has made it very clear that it wants Hezbollah disarmed, leaving it only as a political party rather than an armed force alongside the regular Lebanese military. This had already been demanded last summer but was not enforced. Now, at least domestically, Hezbollah's renewed attacks seem to have pushed the situation almost to the breaking point. I also spoke with friends in Lebanon, not only Christians but also Shia residents, who said they strongly disagree with the fighting Hezbollah is conducting, which is putting the entire country in danger. And certainly, every day is a risk for Israeli civilians along this border. The same is true for civilians in Lebanon and for all people affected by this multi-front war. It is, of course, to be hoped for everyone in the region that this war ends quickly and that peace is finally restored. This was In Crisis Mode. The podcast was produced by Alexander Baumeister, who is also a journalist with the Funke Media Group's radio network. If you enjoy our podcast, please like, follow, and recommend us. You can also write to us at krisenmodus@funkemedien.de. Take care of yourselves. Until next time, ciao ciao. Shalom. Salam alaikum. See you.
Ein Podcast von Funke.